Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 887, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on January 24th of the year 2016. As the title of the program indicates, this broadcast will be updating and further developing points of information that we have had in past programs, and in some cases, introducing new information that will further enhance our understanding of things that we have spoken about in the past. Looking ahead to the very last item that we will be covering on this program, none other than Vito Gelli, the Grand Master of the Propaganda Due Lodge in Italy, that also had branches in Monaco, a very important one in Argentina, and in Uruguay, that had people within the Republican Party of the U.S. that exerted consummate influence on the Vatican and has echoing influence to this day with people like Silvio Berlusconi, a member of his Gelli's P2 Lodge. Gelli finally passed away in December of last year at the ripe old age of 96, and we certainly would be remiss if we did not note this very important individual who wielded a sinister influence for a long, long time. However, the Gelli obituary and summary analysis will be the last item that we will be dealing with. As I record this program on January 24th of 2016, among the items that is not exactly dominating the news, but certainly garnering a fair amount of media coverage, is the standoff at an animal refuge, a federally owned animal refuge in Oregon, by a paramilitary group led by Ammon Bundy. That's A-double-M-O-N Bundy. He is the son of Nevada rancher Cleven Bundy, who also was the beneficiary of paramilitary anti-government militia who stood down government agents who were attempting to collect back taxes from Ammon Bundy, who for many years had been grazing his cattle on federal land and refused to pay what he owed in grazing fees. Cleven Bundy, rather, was the beneficiary of a tremendous amount of good press on Fox News until he finally came out of the woodwork, so to speak, and revealed himself to be deeply racist. At that point, Fox News, simply in order to maintain their credibility going into a presidential election cycle, drew back from him, at least superficially. And although the likes of Ammon Bundy and Cleven Bundy would appear to be far removed from the halls of corporate governance and the likes of the Koch brothers and people who populated the George W. Bush administration and the GOP in general, that is not, in fact, the case. We're going to be taking a look at who has been bankrolling things like the Wise Use Movement, people who have been paying the bills of organizations that have been part and parcel to the Fox News agenda. And beyond that, we are going to take a look at some of the common threads that are uniting various forms of libertarianism, whether it is paramilitary gunmen standing down federal agents on government-owned land, or whether it is people like Edward Snowden and Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, both of whose political views and political alliances actually go to the far right rather than to the so-called progressive sector that has backed them and uncritically accepted what it is that they are offering. as I have said in some of the programs that I have done about technocratic fascism, basically the Bundyites and the Snowdenistas and the WikiLeakers are saying basically the same thing, and that is we are going to do what we want, whether it is with government land, basically land owned by the public, or whether it is government information. If we, as Edward Snowden did, get a hold of the architecture of the National Security Agency and choose to give it to private individuals, such as Nazi fellow traveler Glenn Greenwald, yes, I'm sorry, he is just that, or people like Julian Assange, whose initial foray into the public eye took place courtesy of the Pirate Bay website that is financed by Carl Lundstrom, a prominent Swedish fascist and political associate of David Duke. They are saying the same thing. This belongs to us. We don't care if it actually belongs to you. We are going to do with it what we damn well please, and you have no choice but to accept our doing it. More about that later. We are going to be once again referencing a very insightful article by David Golumbi. That's G-O-L-U-M-B-I-A, not C-O-L-U-M-B-I-A, like Columbia University. We're going to equate the basic ethics of the Bundyists with the Kochs, with WikiLeaks, and with the Snowdenistas. As I said in the past, libertarianism has proved to be one of the new manifestations of fascism, although many, I would say, most libertarians are anything but fascists in terms of their sentiments and orientation. However, once you remove rules, only the powerful will be able to execute their agendas. And I use the term execute very advisedly in this circumstance. If I were going to mint a political ideology, it would be a responsibilitarian political ideology. You can have no real freedom unless freedom is married to responsibility. We're going to be taking a look at that, and we are going to be taking a look at what has been happening in Europe, where anti-immigrant militias, basically in effect, not necessarily carrying guns in the streets, but exercising armed force against those with whom they disagree, the types of individuals who are financed by the very same Carl Lundstrom who financed the Pirate Bay WikiLeaks site. He has also, Lundstrom that is, has also financed the Sweden Democrats, an inappropriate title that is a Swedish fascist party that has been minting valuable political coinage on the anti-immigrant sentiment that is sweeping Europe. We'll be taking a look at that and a number of other things as well. Now, about the Bundyists, as I call them, I'm going to begin with an article from the New York Times of January 10th of 2016. This is by Alan Feuer, F-E-U-E-R, of the New York Times. The ideological roots of the Oregon standoff, it reads in part. It is tempting to dismiss the anti-government gunman who took control of an animal refuge in Oregon on January 2nd as fanatics working at the very fringes of American politics. But if the methods used by the rancher Amon Bundy to seize federal property were radical, the ideological roots of the operation were somewhat more mainstream. By storming the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge and vowing to return it by force of arms, if necessary, to the people of Harney County, Mr. Bundy and his men were echoing the teachings, if not the tactics, of the Wise Use Movement, a conservative land use doctrine that has been a part of the national discourse for nearly 30 years. A successor to the Sagebrush Rebellion of the 1970s, itself a successor to the anti-national parks boomers project of the early 1900s, wise use answers the question of who should own the West by granting moral primacy to natural resource companies and to logging and ranching families like the Bundys, some of which have worked the land since the pioneer expansion. Though composed of many activists and scores of organizations, Wise Use found its voice in the late 1980s when a timber industry advisor named Ron Arnold published The Wise Use Agenda. That manifesto offered an expansive plan to gut environmental regulation, increase private ownership of public land, and compel the federal government to open its holdings to mining, oil, and logging companies, and to the unrestricted use of off-road vehicles. In 1988, Arnold held a conference bringing together the likes of Exxon and the National Cattlemen's Association with the goal of seeding the West with grassroots groups that could wrest control of federal land and give a local flavor to his Reaganite aims. Quote, Arnold sent organizers into distressed rural communities to set up front groups with environmentally friendly sounding names that whipped up hostility against the government, said Tarso, T-A-R-S-O, Ramos, R-A-M-O-S, the executive director of Political Research Associates, a research group that studies right-wing movements. What resulted, Mr. Ramos said, was a, quote, coalition of natural resource companies, property developers, and conservative activists working with a network of community organizations. This coalition achieved success in pushing its agendas. By the early 1990s, politicians friendly to the Wise Use cause had introduced or passed legislation in nearly 30 states, giving local governments and citizens expanded powers to lay claim to federal land. Among those politicians was Representative Helen Chenoweth Hage, H-A-G-E, an Idaho Republican who became notorious for mocking the Endangered Species Act by holding what she called endangered salmon bakes. There was also Gail A. Norton, the Interior Secretary under President George W. Bush, who once worked as a lawyer for the Mountain States Legal Foundation, which has billed itself as, quote, the litigation arm of Wise Use, unquote. The Wise Use crowd got very close to the centers of power, Mr. Ramos said. It also got close to the militia movement, experts say. In 1994, the National Federal Lands Conference, a Wise Use group that maintained that county governments should control federal land, published an article in its newsletter that bore the title, quote, Why There Is a Need for the Militia in America, unquote. Around the same time, Wise Use rallies often featured pamphlets from groups like the Militia of Montana, said David Helvarg, H-E-L-V-A-R-G, the author of The War Against the Greens. Nor was it a coincidence, said James McCarthy, a professor of geography at Clark University, that militia members in camouflage fatigues conducted armed exercises in the very federal forests in New Mexico that the Wise Use movement was trying at the time to pry away from Washington's control.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com. Also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Quote, there were many people who were active simultaneously in the Wise Use movement and militia movements and who saw them as different manifestations of the same phenomenon, Mr. McCarthy said, skipping down. The question stands as to why vigilantes with AR-15 rifles have repeatedly confronted the government on behalf of local landowners in the West. A classic Wise Use principle, if not a Wise Use tactic. This spring, gunmen from the Oath Keepers militia group helped the owners of an Oregon gold mine chase away federal agents who were trying to enforce a stop work order. A few months later, another Oath Keeper tactical team stopped the government from shutting down a mine in the National Forest in Montana. Part of the answer is that in the region where the ground itself is largely owned by agencies in Washington, the wise youths and militia movements share, quote, the same seething resentment at federal overreach, unquote, said Jeffrey St. Clair, a journalist who has written about environmental politics in the West for 30 years. If the wise youths movement did not condone or support militias, it created an intellectual framework for militia operations and has, on occasion, lent the groups ideological ballast. In some way, Mr. St. Clair said, the Patriot Movement is glomming on to the wise youths movement as something that has a political presence and a real-world power that the Patriot Movement has never had, unquote. After the Bush years, the wise youths movement lost much of its vibrancy, and even Mr. Arnold acknowledged that it is little known today. But the relationship between activists in suits and angry men with guns continues apace. Last year, Michelle Fiore, F-I-O-R-E, a Republican assemblywoman in Nevada, introduced a bill to prohibit the federal government from owning or managing land in Nevada without the state's consent. Ms. Fiore, as it happens, is also a strong supporter of the Bundys. A month after her bill was introduced, she debated Chris Hayes on MSNBC, live from the standoff at the Bundy family ranch. We're going to, in a sense, take a look at some of the big money behind this, you know, ostensibly anti-authoritarian grassroots, you know, don't fence me in, home on the range, sort of thing that has been promoted as the cachet of Amon and Cleveland Bundy. That money, not surprisingly, comes from interests like the Koch brothers and their oil drilling and mining operations that have long been opposed to any environmental restrictions. Before we go to that, I want to recommend that listeners also access a lecture that is in the lectures category of the SpitfireList.com website. It's called The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State, and I think that will provide some interesting insights as well. Now, of Fox News, its promotion of Cleveland Bundy, Amon Bundy's father, and in turn, the relationship between Fox News and institutions that are funded by the Koch brothers, and the political agenda of the Koch brothers, which basically is very similar to the wise youth movement. By the way, too, note that the Oath Keeper militia had successfully prevented a couple of mines from being shut down. One of the reasons why there are federal regulations, I am not intimately familiar with federal land use regulations in the West. Certainly bureaucracies and the federal government is nothing if not that. It can be very inflexible. I would note that the very budget cutting that the political right wing advocates tends to make those bureaucracies even less flexible, because increasingly as staff is cut, the paperwork that is generated to enforce their very regulations is done by computers. And increasingly, the federal government is issuing forth paperwork and directives that really have not been seen by human eyes or reviewed by human brains. However, if you happen to be, for the sake of argument, living in a state that is downriver from another state that has permitted mining on federal lands, and if they are not adhering to proper environmental regulations as enforced by the federal government, if they wind up pouring toxic tailings into the river, or if those tailings find their way into groundwater, or if fracking, hydraulic fracturing, winds up either pumping toxins into the groundwater, or perhaps pumping groundwater into active earthquake faults, people should not complain when they wound up being poisoned, rather in the way that people in Flint, Michigan were poisoned by their polluted water supply coming from the Flint River. Mining waste, it tends to be very, very toxic, and it can last a very long time. So if you live downriver from a wise use mine, and if they dump the tailings into the water supply you were drinking, don't complain when your kids get cancer. And if you can't afford health insurance, well, that is too bad. That's the way it goes. It's also why, in the end, people have sought control by governments which have, at least in theory, some democratic participation. Now, again, when you dolly the camera to the right and you move away from Amon Bundy and Cleveland Bundy and the paramilitaries in fatigues with assault rifles, you find people like the Koch brothers who fund Lincoln Center. The Media Matters blog of April 25th, 2014 has a very insightful article by Olivia Kittel, or Kittel, K-I-T-T-E-L. The money behind Fox's promotion of Cleveland Bundy's battle with the feds, it reads in part, skipping down. Nevada rancher Cleveland Bundy became Fox News' favorite folk hero after he refused to comply with court orders directing him to remove his trespassing cattle from public land. Hannity and many other right-wing media rallied around Bundy and his armed supporters as they threatened violence against federal law enforcement officials attempting to impound Bundy's cattle and collect the $1 million he owes in fines and fees after decades of noncompliance with the law. Parenthetically, that $1 million would be owed to the government and would help to reduce the deficit by $1 million. Continuing, Bundy has said he doesn't recognize the existence of the federal government, nor its authority over the land, and has attacked the federal ownership of lands as subverting Nevada's state sovereignty, unquote. Hannity has promoted Bundy's anti-government rhetoric, arguing that the federal government owns far too much land, and pushing Bundy's claim that not only does the federal government not have land ownership authority, but that they don't need or use the land they claim to own. On the April 23rd edition of his show, Hannity attacked the government for owning too much land, agreeing with Fox News legal analyst Andrew Napolitano that they do not have the constitutional authority to own any of the land. Throughout the land battle, Hannity continuously argued that the government is irresponsibly fighting for land they have no intended use for, such as building hospitals, schools, or roads, and should focus their efforts elsewhere to rapists, murderers, criminals, and pedophiles. Skipping down. Bundy's anti-federal agenda is closely aligned with that of Charles and David Koch, major Republican donors who have been pushing for states to gain control over federal lands so they can be sold or leased to people like the Koch brothers in deals. Fox News Network and Sean Hannity have a particular interest in the promotion and realization of such Koch interests because their funding depends on it. Hannity receives major funding and large ad buys from Koch-affiliated Heritage and Tea Party patriots. Hannity's Koch-affiliated funders have a long history of promoting the privatization of public lands and condemning the federal ownership of land. Tea Party groups have supported local efforts to transfer federal lands. Heritage has advocated shrinking the U.S. government's control by selling its physical assets, such as huge swaths of land, especially out west. Heritage was also a loyal promoter of the Federal Land Freedom Act of 2013, advocating for the transfer of federal land management to state regulators for energy resource development. Giving airtime to an issue that is obscure but significant to his conservative funders makes perfect sense for Hannity. Politico reported that Heritage began sponsoring Hannity in 2008, and in 2013, Hannity began advertising for the Tea Party Patriots, quote, lending his name to fundraising draws, hosting its leaders on his radio and Fox News shows, and even using the Fox airwaves to promote the Tea Party Patriots website, unquote. The Koch brothers have been covertly funding right-wing organizations such as Heritage Action and the Tea Party Patriots through the nonprofit business league Freedom Partners, whose tax code status as a trade association allows the organization to conceal its donors. Freedom Partners is one of the largest donors of conservative groups, and its board has deep ties to the Koch brothers, with many of its members being longtime employees of Koch Industries and the Charles G. Koch Foundation. The Koch-funded Freedom Partners made grants of $236 million in 2011. Among many conservative groups, its recipients include Heritage as well as the Tea Party Patriots. Heritage Action received $500,000 in 2011 from the Koch brothers through Freedom Partners and additional funds from the Charles G. Koch Charitable Foundation. In 2012, the Tea Party Patriots received $200,000 from Freedom Partners. The legislative efforts of such groups to transfer control of federal lands to states are, quote, nothing more than corporate-backed messaging tools, unquote, initiated by conservative groups like the Koch affiliates. That statement again, because this really goes to the thrust of what Ayman and Cleveland Bundy and the Oath Keepers and others are really doing. The legislative efforts of such groups to transfer control of federal lands to states are, quote, nothing more than corporate-backed messaging tools, unquote, initiated by conservative groups like the Koch affiliates. Such efforts are rooted in the interests of the Kochs and other conservative groups to use the land in whichever way is most profitable to them, such as mining, drilling, and other resource extraction. I would note that Fox News expert Andrew Napolitano, who was cited in the article I just read, was among the honored guests at a recent Students for Liberty conference. Students for Liberty is ostensibly a libertarian organization. They are opposed to government surveillance, and for that reason had Edward Snowden Skype in as an honored participant at the same conference at which Andrew Napolitano was a guest. They are, however, very much in favor of corporate surveillance of all kinds of people. That is one of the things that I have warned about. People are all bent out of shape about the NSA. Well, there are two levels to the information that Snowden basically had. One of them has been on the public record for years, and I've spoken about it on and off from open sources for the better part of two decades. The other, the architecture of the NSA, is now in the hands of private people, and Edward Snowden not only was not authorized to disclose that, frankly, I can tell you that Snowden could not possibly have gotten that information the way he claims he did. Edward Snowden is a spy. He could not have gotten it by getting the passwords of some of his fellow contractors at some of the firms with which he worked. Taking information like that and putting it into private hands could ultimately be devastating. But most people, talking about the NSA again before we move on, most people have nothing. The average listener to this program should not be worried in the least about the National Security Agency. They should, however, be very concerned about these tech companies who are basically, and with the acquiescence, even the enthusiastic acquiescence of most of the people, I would say, in our society, who with their mobile technology and social networks and various apps up the yin-yang are giving every last detail of their personal lives and those of their friends to corporate interests who basically are using that as a major capital resource for making money. Privacy, essentially, is largely a myth at this point, and that is due to the actions of major corporations. People have far more to fear from, say, Facebook or one of our companies like that, the tech giants like Google, than they do from the NSA.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
That was one of the points that was made by David Golumbia, G-O-L-U-M-B-I-A, in a very important article that we have used in the past from uncomputing.org of April 23rd of 2015. In an article called Tor, Technocracy, and Democracy, he made that basic point, which is that people like Snowden and WikiLeaks and the hacktivists are technocrats who are occupying exactly the same turf as the technocratic giants such as Facebook and Google. And I would point out that they are also occupying the same turf as people like Andrew Napolitano, Eamon and Cleven Bundy, and the Koch brothers and Fox News and the Wise Use Movement. The basic thrust of Snowden and WikiLeaks in our discussions of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, who has the same free market philosophy of economics as the Koch brothers, Edward Snowden is hooked up with ultra-right-wing libertarians. He was an enthusiastic supporter of Ron Paul. Ron Paul's chief legal counsel for his 2012 campaign run or presidential run, a guy named Bruce Fine, again, the chief legal counsel for Ron Paul's 2012 campaign, and the counsel for the Snowden family and Edward Snowden's first attorney. Snowden and WikiLeaks are of the same basic philosophy. Julian Assange said he stopped counting when he had 1 terabyte of information in the WikiLeaks database. That is a lot of information. Who vetted Edward Snowden? Who vetted Julian Assange? And indeed, what did Julian Assange do with that information? He put it on the Pirate Bay website, financed by Carl Lundstrom, one of Sweden's most prominent fascists, an associate of David Duke, and the financier of the Sweden Democrats, an anti-immigrant far-right-wing party that began as an Odinist Nordic party and then sort of cleaned up its image. We're going to talk about parties like the Sweden Democrats, but when you take information that is in the public realm, basically, whether it's NSA information or the information of some other government agency, and you arrogate to yourself the right to do with that as you see fit, you are doing with information exactly the same thing as Cleven and Eamon Bundy and the Oath Keepers are doing with federal land. You are taking that which does not belong to you and doing with it as you damn well see fit. The technocratic fascism that David Golumbia correctly saw here is at one with the paramilitary fascism of the likes of Eamon Bundy and Cleven Bundy, again, doing the groundwork for people like the Koch brothers. Golumbia described this, telescoping this somewhat. The political world is theirs to do with what they want, and the rest of us should stay out of it. Members of democratic polities have no choice but to accept them having that role. And that article reads, again, Tor, Technocracy and Democracy by David Golumbia from uncomputing.org from April 23rd of 2015. Such technocratic beliefs are widespread in our world today, especially in the enclaves of digital enthusiasts, whether or not they are part of the giant corporate digital leviathan. Hackers, civic, ethical, white, and black hat alike, hacktivists, WikiLeaks fans, and Julian Assange, anonymous members, even Edward Snowden himself, walk hand in hand with Facebook and Google, and I would add with Cleveland and Ayman Bundy and the Koch brothers and the Wise Use movement, in telling us that coders don't just have good things to contribute to the political world, but that the political world is theirs to do with what they want, and the rest of us should stay out of it. The political world is broken, they appear to think, rightly, at least in part, and the solution to that, they think, wrongly, at least for the most part, is for programmers or militias to take political matters into their own hands. And then there is more discussed here in that passage. We have read it into the record many, many times. But again, note with the libertarian ethos that has ostensibly driven the likes of Ayman and Cleveland Bundy on the one hand, and also people like Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. You'll notice that people like Andrew Napolitano and Edward Snowden wind up at the same events. Ron Paul was at that same Students for Liberty conference. And as we are going to see, Carl Lundstrom, who financed the Pirate Bay website that hosted WikiLeaks, also finances the Sweden Democrats. And we're going to take a look at the anti-immigrant European fascist parties and their growth and enthusiasm later on in this program. It should come as no great surprise to veteran listeners to learn that Fred C. Koch, the father of Charles and David Koch, helped to construct the third largest oil refinery in Nazi Germany. We have spoken about the profound corporate connections of American industry and finance to those of the Third Reich and other fascist parties in numerous programs. The New York Times of January 11th of 2016 has an article by Nicholas Confessori, C-O-N-F-E-S-S-O-R-E, father of Koch brothers helped build Nazi oil refinery, book says. It reads in part, the father of the billionaires Charles G. and David H. Koch helped construct a major oil refinery in Nazi Germany that was personally approved by Adolf Hitler, according to a new history of the Kochs and other wealthy families. The book Dark Money by Jane Mayer traces the rise of the modern conservative movement through the activism and money of a handful of rich donors, among them Richard Mellon Scaife, an heir to the Mellon banking fortune, and Harry and Lynn Bradley, brothers who became wealthy in part from military contracts but poured millions into anti-government philanthropy. But the book is largely focused on the Koch family, stretching back to its involvement in the far-right John Birch Society and the political and business activities of the father, Fred C. Koch, who found some of his earliest business success overseas in the years leading up to World War II. One venture was a partnership with the American Nazi sympathizer William Rhodes Davis, who, according to Ms. Mayer, hired Mr. Koch to help build the third largest oil refinery in the Third Reich, a critical industrial cog in Hitler's war machine. The episode is not mentioned in an online history published by Koch Industries, the company that Mr. Koch later founded and passed on to his sons. I would note that the father, Fred Koch, was a big, overt admirer of Mussolini and, again, one of the founders of the John Birch Society. Speaking of Hitler, we have spoken in a number of programs about the escape of Adolf Hitler. His death was a myth. In fact, the official version of the death of Adolf Hitler was authored by Hugh Trevor Roper, who was working for MI6, British Foreign Intelligence, and the operation, a psyop, was called Operation Nursery. There is abundant evidence that Hitler actually escaped. Exactly where he wound up remains a subject of some debate. We have spoken about the escape of Hitler in a number of programs, including, for the record, 791 and also 864. And for the record, 791, we accessed information from the book Grey Wolf about the escape of Hitler, in which the authors theorized that Alan Dulles on the Allied Sod and Martin Bormann on the Nazi side arranged the escape of Adolf Hitler in exchange for the transfer of Nazi military expertise to the West under Project Paperclip for use in the Cold War, as well as for the sparing of much of Western artistic culture. Basically, the Nazis, as is well known, had laid their hands on much of the valuable artwork of the West, and in exchange for not destroying that, they allegedly agreed, they worked out a deal with Dulles to allow Hitler to escape. There is a documentary on the History Channel called Hunting Hitler that features the work of the authors of Grey Wolf. And one of the people who has endorsed the notion that Hitler actually escaped is a veteran CIA officer named Robert Baer, last name B-A-E-R. We have accessed his book, Sleeping with the Devil, in past programs. And in the article that was featured in the Daily Mail of January 8th of 2016, the article is by Darren Boyle. Hola Hitler, ex-CIA agent claims Nazi leader faked his death and flew to Tenerife, T-E-N-E-R-I-F-E, before escaping to Argentina on a U-boat. This article by Darren Boyle features the claims of Robert Baer, again, an esteemed CIA officer who finally blew the whistle on this country's relationship with Saudi Arabia in, among other books, Sleeping with the Devil. Of Hitler's escape, we read, a CIA agent with more than 21 years field experience claims newly declassified evidence suggests that Adolf Hitler faked his own death before escaping to the Canary Islands by air before continuing on to Argentina by U-boat. Bob Baer, who spent his lifetime involved in counterintelligence and espionage, said the official version of history with Hitler killing himself in his Berlin bunker does not stand up to official scrutiny. He claims that newly released FBI files suggest that investigators at the time were also suspicious about whether the Nazi dictator had shot himself in the head. According to the Hunting Hitler documentary on History Channel, there was no eyewitness report of Hitler's suicide or of anyone discovering his body inside his bunker. The team, following snippets of evidence, said it was plausible that Hitler could have faked his own death and escaped through the Tempelhof airport on the day after he was last seen in public. One of the aircraft which left during the mass Nazi exodus is believed to have contained Hitler's luggage. During the controversial documentary series, Baer claims, the narrative the government gives us is a lie. If you look at the FBI files, it throws open the investigation. Again, for the record, 864, and for the record, 791. Go into that at some length.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
On New Year's Eve, a number of European cities, including several in Germany, were the sites of some attacks on women, ranging from purse snatching to sexual molestation and rape. And many of those assaults were perpetrated by recent immigrants from the Middle East. Those assaults have lent great fervor to the anti-immigrant sentiment in European cities. As I mentioned, WikiLeaks held forth on the Pirate Bay website that was financed by Carl Lundstrom, a political associate of David Duke, and the main financier of not only the Pirate Bay website, but also of the Sweden Democrats, which are one of these anti-immigrant European fascist parties that are gaining emitting very valuable political coinage from the anti-immigrant sentiment, not unlike the way people like Donald Trump are doing in the U.S. There was a statement by the German Justice Minister, a guy named Heiko, or Heiko, H-E-I-K-O, Maas, M-A-S-S, M-A-A-S, that those attacks may have been planned. Now, whether or not they were planned, those attacks certainly are fueling the fires of political reaction in Europe. The Euractiv.com blog of January 11th of 2016, German minister hints sexual assaults were planned. Attacks on women in Cologne and other German cities on New Year's Eve have prompted more than 600 criminal complaints, and the German minister said the sexual assaults may have been either planned and or coordinated. The attacks, mostly targeting women and ranging from theft to sexual molestation, have prompted a highly charged debate in Germany about the welcoming stance for refugees and migrants, more than 1 million of whom arrived last year. The sudden nature of the violent attacks and the fact that they stretched from Hamburg to Frankfurt prompted German Minister of Justice Heiko Maas, again, H-E-I-K-O-M-A-A-S, to speculate in the newspaper that they had been planned or coordinated. Skipping down. A survey sponsored by state broadcaster ARD showed that while 75% of those asked were very happy with Merkel's work in April of last year, only 58% were pleased now. Almost three-quarters of those polled said migration was the most important issue for the government to deal with in 2016. Skipping down. The anti-Islamic nationalist group Pegida, whose supporters threw bottles and firecrackers at a march in Cologne on Saturday before being dispersed by riot police, will later hold a rally in the eastern German city of Leipzig. And we're going to see right now just what happened when they held that rally in Leipzig. I would note that there certainly was forewarning in Finland to the Finnish police whether these were the tips were passed on by people who simply heard people saying that they were going to Middle Eastern immigrants were going to go down to and raise a little hell on New Year's Eve. Not in and of itself all that surprising. People of all kinds do things like that on New Year's Eve. Whether there was more to that is a subject for speculation. I would note in this regard that the notion of the raping of women by people of cultural and or racial differences is a powerful, powerful propaganda and psychological warfare element for, well, really, a couple of centuries. Violence against African Americans, from lynching to various aspects of the Jim Crow laws, has been fueled by the notion that black men were lusting after and raping white women. Dylan Roof, the South Carolina church shooter, was saying much the same thing to the African Americans as he was gunning them down. You are raping our women. The notion of, again, sexual molestation, of raping the white woman by, you know, whether it's African Americans or Middle Eastern immigrants, is a powerful, powerful, powerful cultural and political element. And whether or not the attacks were planned, I would not certainly endorse that. However, as we have noted in For the Record 830 and For the Record 882, the anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim sentiment fueling the rise of European fascist groups and catering to the likes of the Sweden Democrats or the Front National in France or Pegida or others. The notion is, you see, these immigrants, you can't trust them. Look what they're doing. They're raping our women, as Dylan Roof claimed. You have to side with us. We are your only hope. At the same time, the Islamic fascists of the Muslim Brotherhood variety are saying, you see, look at those infidels. They will never accept you into their society. You cannot trust them. Side with us. We are your only hope, is what I have called Machiavelli 3.0 or Machiavelli 4.0 in this instance. Whether or not the attacks were planned, I can't say that. However, one of the things that I would not dismiss is that some of the Islamic fascists allied with the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic State, and related groups may have seen something like that as a wonderful way of producing the very type of reaction that they want in order to say to the large Muslim populations in Europe, you see how those infidels are? You can't trust them. They will never accept you. You must side with us. We are your only hope, just as the likes of Pegida, the Sweden Democrats, the Front National, and others are saying, you see, look at those immigrants. Look at those Muslims. Look what they're doing. They're raping our women. You can never accept them into your midst. We are your only hope. Side with us. It is what I called in For the Record 882, the perfect storm. And believe me, in the U.S. presidential race, not just Donald Trump, but others are minting valuable political coinage with just exactly that same gambit. And what are the results? Unprecedented sex harassment in Helsinki at New Year Finnish police report by Richard Orange, this from the Daily Telegraph, of January 8th of 2016. Asylum seekers who met in central Helsinki to celebrate New Year's Eve, quote, had similar plans, unquote, to commit sexual assaults and other crimes as those who targeted women in the German city of Cologne, Finnish police have reported. Three Iraqi asylum seekers have been arrested for committing sexual assaults during the celebrations in the city's Senate Square, where some 20,000 had gathered. Security personnel reported widespread sexual harassment during the celebrations, police added, with women complaining that asylum seekers had groped their breasts and kissed them without permission. This phenomenon is new in Finnish sexual crime history. Ika Koskimaki, K-O-S-K-I-M-A-K-I, the deputy chief of police in Helsinki, told the Telegraph, again quoting, "We have never before had this kind of sexual harassment happening at New Year's Eve." He said that the police had received tip-offs from staff at the asylum reception centers, skipping down. Unarmed militia groups calling themselves Soldiers of Odin, wearing black jackets and hats marked SOO, have sprung up in several towns in Finland where asylum seekers are housed, claiming they want to protect citizens from Islamic intruders, unquote. Sort of the Nordic manifestation of the Oath Keepers, the militia. We will protect you. We will be your bulwark against injustice. Again, the Soldiers of Odin. And remember that there was a march that was scheduled by Pegida for Leipzig. What happened in that city? This from the Daily Mail of January 12th of 2016. An article by Alan Hall, Jenny Stanton, and Tom Wyke, W-Y-K-E. Terrifying echoes of Kristallnacht. Mayor condemns naked violence, unquote, after far-right thugs rampage through the streets of Germany, smashing windows of kebab shops. The mayor of a German city has spoken of terror on the streets of his city after far-right thugs ran riot in scenes reminiscent of the anti-Semitic Kristallnacht attacks in 1938. Burkhard Jung, mayor of Leipzig, has condemned the naked violence that took place after doner kebab fast food restaurants were destroyed, cars were set ablaze, and shop windows were smashed by around 250 hooligans of Legida, L-E-G-I-D-A, the local branch of Pegida, P-E-G-I-D-A, an anti-migrant, anti-EU organization on Monday night. The rampage in Leipzig evoked memories of the wave of violence against Jews that erupted across Nazi Germany and parts of Austria on November 9th, 1938. When daylight broke in Leipzig, scenes were similar to those that followed Kristallnacht, the name referring to the shards of glass left strewn across cities in the aftermath of the bloody pogroms. The anniversary of the night in November was due to coincide with a weekly demonstration by the Gita, and the right-wing movement had planned to walk past the site of the synagogue that was burned to the ground during Kristallnacht. Skipping down again, the violence in Leipzig followed on from weekend attacks in Cologne by a vigilante mob which used the social networking site Facebook to marshal young men, rockers, bodybuilders, and club bouncers to go on a manhunt, unquote, for immigrants. One of the people who in many ways has laid the foundation for the upsurge in fascism around the world passed away. A very, very important fellow, well known to veteran listeners to this program, a guy named Licio, L-I-C-I-O, Geli, G-E-L-L-I. He was the head of the P2 Lodge, ostensibly Masonic lodge. It actually was a crypto-fascist government that ruled Italy behind the scenes for many years. He passed away in December. The New York Times of December 18th, 2015 had an obituary by Sam Roberts. Licio Geli, Italian financier and cabal leader, dies at 96. The essence of Geli was in a quote that was in this obit. I was born under fascism. I studied with fascism. I fought for fascism. I am a fascist, and I will die a fascist. It talks about his death at the age of 96. He was involved in so many things. I'm not going to read the obituary. It is in almost its entirety in the printed description for this program that will be available later today, today being January 24th of 2016. His P2 Lodge wielded decisive control over Vatican finances through Michele Sindona and Roberto Calvi, both of whom died under very strange circumstances. It wielded a profound influence over the Italian intelligence services. It was involved in the Borghese coup attempt of 1970 and the Rosa Diventi coup attempt of 1973, both of which received arms from Otto Skorzeny, the SS commando leader and Odessa chieftain. A fellow named Philip Guarino, part of the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, basically the Nazi slash fascist wing of the Republican Party. He was an American member of the P2. In Argentina in the 1970s, they had their Dirty War in which thousands of people were disappeared and murdered. That junta was dominated by people who were Argentine members of the P2. Admiral Emilio Massera, President Jorge Videla, the General Carlos Suarez Mason, and others were all members of the Argentine branch of the P2. The bridegrooms of death of Klaus Barbie had a fellow named Pierluigi Pagliai, who was a member of the group, Stefano Della Chiai, a key terror implementer in Europe and Latin America, was very closely associated with the P2. Silvio Berlusconi, one of the leading figures in contemporary Italian politics, was a member of the P2. There are numerous evidentiary tributaries running from the P2 to the milieu of September 11th as well. We talked about them last week, and there will be some of those references in the description for the record, 887. However, this is all we have time for today. This concludes For the Record 887, miscellaneous articles and updates being recorded on January 24th of the year 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.